Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to the 909 podcast. On this episode, I have a special guest who I asked to come on and chat to me about a film called Meet Me in the Bathroom. You may have heard about it, you may have seen it. A documentary about the New York City music scene of the early 2000s. I said, come and chat to me about Meet Me in the Bathroom. And he said, I'll come and meet you in your gaff. It's Dave Hanratty.
Hello. Hi. How's it going? It's an honor, by the way. It's an honor. That was a hell of an intro. You caught me off guard.
I did, yes.
Yeah, Jesus.
That was my intention. You were sitting in front of me.
Yeah.
Not just in
it's
my
true. Ear. I insisted on doing this in person to be really awkward.
Yeah. I mean, this is the first in-person podcast I have done in 2 years or something. Over 2 years. No. Yes. 2 years. Probably 2021 was probably the last time I did one. Yeah.
Was that with Andrea or was that with a different person?
Myself and Andrea and Denise Chyla and God knows and all did it.
That was fucking ages. Am I like cursed? Is that cool?
Yes.
That was ages.
You know, I think you've heard the podcast before.
It's a courtesy thing, you know. Like, yeah. And also, you know, it's the thing of like not being on radio, which I still can't believe it's never happened. It's the worst, right?
You just like, know. You just intrinsically know.
Even on television. Like, I mean, like that's the one where you're like, do not curse.
Don't say anything bad.
Don't say anything weird that you don't actually feel.
That's actually worse.
Yeah.
That is the worst thing about like just been on TV, I think. The two times I've been on it. Yeah, like I do it all the time. Like I'm a presenter on Virgin Media News. No, I'm not.
You could be.
If you put
your mind to it.
That was what I was doing. I was talking about lockdown the last time I was on with Matt Cooper.
You know,
you do the radio all the time. The best like radio guesting is when you just feel relaxed and somebody isn't going kicking
yeah.
at you
yeah
saying,
no,
come
it's,
on
it's fast paced I say as like a contributor who's on every now and then on Today FM or RT, but like it's all very sporadic. I do love doing it, but yeah, it is that thing of it's so different from this because we're already just chatting, but yeah, like you have to hit marks and hit beats and you know,
yeah, there's time limits and all that stuff. There's an art to that as well, the production art to that in radio. I used to love when I had a show on TXFM actually just hitting the mark for the news, because you have to like give a certain amount of time and you have to fade down a song in order to get the song in, to get the hit the mark so you get in the ads and all that stuff. So
I had one recently. I was on Arena, and Sean Rocks, who's like the greatest, most gregarious, cool guy, I was reading a show and he was very much like, he's like, and Dave's got, you know, 14 minutes to get through this with me and I'm sure he's gonna, and I was like, all right, cool, weird proviso. But at the end of it, he's like and Dave's wrapped up with just, you know, he's like with 30 seconds spare, and I thank him for it. And I went, you're very welcome. And I realized, oh fuck, I've probably like crashed over, like I shouldn't have said anything there.
Yeah.
And when I went to listen, when they uploaded it, I was like, please, 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 please. And it was magic. It worked perfectly. But you don't know that, you know, and you're just like, it's that thing where you're like, when they sign you off, you're just like, do I say anything? Do I just nod?
It's like your inner politeness is like, thanks, whoever you are.
Yeah. And then we'd never make it in cool New York bands, I think is what I'm trying to get at here.
Well, that's it. That's what we're going to talk about. And funny enough, there's a lot of interviews in this film, Meet Me in the Bathroom. So, okay. So briefly, what is Meet Me in the Bathroom? Some of the Niall or Nine Discord crew went to see it over the weekend in the Lighthouse Cinema. Thanks to the Lighthouse for sorting that out for us. So Meet Me in the Bathroom is a film about music that means a lot to a lot of people of our age group. We're talking The Strokes, Interpol, Yeah Yeah Yeahs, LCD Sound System. They're the main bands that are in this. It's based on a book of the same name by Lizzie Goodman, Meet Me in the Bathroom, who is actually apparently making a drama series about this now.
So, which might explain her lack of involvement with this directly, yeah.
So getting a lot of mileage out of it. Meet Me in the Bathroom is directed by Will Lovelace and Dylan Sullivan, who are responsible for LCD Sound System, Shut Up and Play the Hits, the Madison Square Garden film, live film.
Is that good, by the way?
It's great, yeah.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, God. I actually was looking, during the week, I love that gig so much because the reason I love it is because, okay, I love LCD. We'll get into that anyway. But I love the set that they've done because it for that, like, obviously it was supposed to be their last ever. Boo-hoo. Spoiler alert, it wasn't.
Yeah. No, Sales did the same thing.
It's like two and a half hours. Yeah. You know, it's 2.5 hours. And it's like the first hour is like, do you remember they did that Nike mix?
Yes.
45-33.
It was kind of good.
It was great.
Yeah.
But they play it live, most of it. And you're like, wow, okay.
What a waste. Yeah.
But no, it's great. It is really good. And Reggie Watts comes out and does bits with them. And
okay, right.
It's really cool. Yeah. Obviously cancelled now, but Arcade Fire in it.
They're not that cancelled though. I keep seeing. I don't think.
There's no such thing as cancel culture.
There's not. And I also, of course, as you know, I interviewed Wynn Butler, but 2 weeks before those allegations came out. And boy, did I take that interview tweet down pretty fast.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
I had no idea. Who did?
Yeah. Well, it happens. Sometimes you talk to people and then do bad things.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Meet Me in the Bathroom. It is really a document of that time from the early 2000s to probably 2009 or so. Let's take a bit from the Meet Me in the Bathroom trailer as context.
What's more important, good sound or a good time?
Sounding good, having a good time.
I remember thinking maybe New York isn't the kind of city anymore that produces iconic bands.
The Strokes launched a fireball.
Started playing New York a year ago. We've been tearing stuff up.
A lot of people quit their jobs and just were like, I'm gonna play music full time.
We felt like we were gonna take over the world.
People went crazy for it.
Suddenly, there were bands everywhere. It all happened so fast.
We're ready. Right, team? Go, team.
Today.
Julian was telling me how scared he was. Things were never going to be normal for him again.
Being a woman fronting a rock band, I was sensationalized.
There was a lot of tension in the studio.
He said, you really don't want people to hear this.
But I've lived in fear my whole life, and I had nothing to lose.
You could feel the love from the community.
You could fail, and it didn't matter.
It was about freedom.
It became our home.
Those years were the big bang of my life.
You guys want to be in a documentary?
There's a lot to get through here. The directors also were responsible for the Blur film, No Distance Left to Run as well. Or No Distance to Run. Have you seen that?
I have not, no. I need to cop on and watch more music documentaries because I went through a phase where I watched loads of them and then I just for some reason became allergic to them.
I think it is easy to do that. I think I have the same feeling with biopics about musicians. They all follow the same beat. I mean, obviously, have you seen Elvis?
Loved Elvis. Yeah, I thought it was great. Yeah.
I mean, I'd forgotten how batshit crazy Baz Luhrmann is at all times. But other than that, I don't know. Yeah, there's a formula. Yeah, there's a formula. So that's formulaic. So, I mean, I guess most documentaries and music documentaries about scenes, I think it maybe has a bit more license to do something interesting because you are certainly leaving things out and you're certainly focusing on certain narratives. And I think overall, I think this is quite a nice, nostalgic film about that scene. It obviously doesn't go as deep into the book. The book is told as an oral history. It has many, many more pages and people and
too many pages, I would say.
Too many pages.
I like the book, but it's fucking, it's crazy over long. And the whole thing, like, let me get this out of the way right away. I think it's a really good book. I think it's great that it's out there. It's very entertaining. And my brain has been completely destroyed by, you know, YouTube and such and such. And like, I used to love reading books when I was a kid. And now I can't read them anymore. So I do appreciate a good oral history, whether it's The Wire oral history or the Saturday Night Live one or this one. It's great to just kind of pick up and put down. But man, I was like, when's this going to end? And also, I'm sorry, but like, as enviable as Lizzie Goodman's life clearly has been, I don't think she and her blogger friends are anywhere near as important as, say, The Strokes, which is what it comes across as. I was like, what the fuck?
Well, it's their perspective, I guess. That's the thing.
Egotistical. That's what I say.
I'm not calling this film egotistical because you just said that.
No, the book.
No, this is a film. I watched a film about the documentary about the Limerick music scene called Out of Place recently in A4 Sound. And it reminded me that there's no way that you can really encapsulate a single city or place's scene, because everything is a perspective of the filmmakers who made this one Out of Place. They made it during lockdown. They focused on three of their friends and their bands that they really liked, therefore not including any stuff about the Limerick rap scene or other than God Knows and Denise and Narrow Lane and all that stuff. But there's lots of other stuff that they couldn't feature because, you know, feature length film, it's not going to work. So this film takes the decision to mainly focus on a few different bands. Yeah, Yeahs, The Strokes, Ryan Adams, the villain of the piece, LCD Sound System, a very slight bit of TV on the Radio.
Yeah, not enough, right? Not enough at all. I love that band. They're phenomenal. Sorry, can I don't mean to derail anything, and this is your show and I'm your hallowed guest and I'm very, very glad to be so. So if I slip into podcast host mode,
please
kick me out of the
building. Please co-host.
But I do want to ask you though, because you use the word nostalgia, and I'm just curious as to like, what is, like, obviously the New York 2001 music scene was literally thousands of miles away for both of us. You weren't living there at the time, were you? I don't think you were.
No.
I've never fucking been to New York. But I'm curious, where were you at in 2001? Like, what were you listening to? Because I was a new metal kid all the way.
Right. Okay. So I had the Strokes album, This Is It, the week it came out.
Wow. Okay.
Because there was such a buzz about him. And I was working that summer in a toy shop.
Wow.
A toy shop that also had a music section.
That sounds like the dream.
Yeah. It was a pretty good summer, actually. So I was looking after the games and the music and all that stuff. Sadly, no records at that time, mostly just CDs. But I remember we all ordered, there was like three or four of us in the shop who had an interest in music, and we all ordered version copies of This Is It by The Strokes so we could buy them and at a staff discount and bring them home. So I had it from the start, but I think that was because it's an interesting perspective, because like Meet Me in the Bathroom comes from, a lot of the music is actually filtered through NME magazine and people like that.
Q magazine as well, which I was reading at the time. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's where, like, I mean, in a way, there's a lot of catching up that the US was doing. There's not a lot of mentions here for some of the big US publications.
Well, it says the version presented, and is this accurate, that they broke the UK first, essentially, The Strokes did?
I think so, because it was that time where,
Rough Trade signed them or something.
Yeah, NME were looking for bands, and that's what they were looking for, American bands, because the Americans, I mean, I think the film does kind of contextualize that a little bit in terms of the MTV generation, you know, your favorites, Limp Bizkit.
They get a dig, Blink-182 get a dig. By the Moldy Peaches, by the way. let me have my Moldy Peaches corner here for just a second, because like, they're one of the worst bands of all time. And this documentary starts off with the Moldy Peaches doing their wacky shtick. And I was like, oh God, really?
Yeah.
They're trying to position them. And like, they were friends with the Strokes. They were on tour with the Strokes. And I'm sure to a lot of people, maybe some even listening right now, they could very well be your band. I think it's twee bullshit. I never, ever got it. I never, ever liked it. So for them to have the gall, Niall, to attack my beloved Limp Bizkit and Blink-182, I was very upset. But I will say, yes, I was very into new metal in 2001, but the Strokes definitely filtered through and kind of kicked that door down. My brother-in-law was a huge fan. He had the album. And I remember him like raving about the drums. And I was like, there's barely any drums on this. Because again, I'm listening to Slipknot, baby.
Yeah.
But of course, in time, I realized, wait a minute. No, it actually is as good as the hype suggests. It actually is a genuinely brilliant, brilliant album. It is brilliant. It is.
And it,
you can't,
that
like,
way.
It's phenomenal.
Yeah. In fairness to the Moldy Peaches, their appearance in it is because they were at the flashpoint of all of this in a way, because they were obviously friends with Julian from The Strokes and they support them on their early shows. And they also contextualize Karen O in Yeah Yeah Yeahs being the quiet, folky acoustic singer-songwriter at an open mic night who just happens to become friends with them and then realizes, oh, actually, maybe I want to do something else. So there is, I mean, most of Peter's music isn't for me necessarily, Kimmy Dawson and Adam Green, but it is interesting that a lot of this film features artists documenting themselves. Like,
yes, I'm glad you mentioned this. Yeah, because it's like I've had this thing happen, whether it's this or whether it's other stuff, where you're like, it's almost like they knew that one day two Irishmen would sit down and have a podcast about it 23 years later. Like, the footage is the best part of this documentary, I will say.
There's great footage.
But like, what the fuck? Like, why are James Murphy and Julian Casablancas and Carano and others filming this guerrilla footage at, you know, kind of underground shows? And I guess, you know, maybe it's just, there's something, like, you wouldn't believe it if it was in a scripted film, but no, this is real footage from 2001.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
I think now, seeing that the Will Lovelace and Dylan Sullivan directed Shut Up and Play the Hits, which does have some documentary elements, maybe some of that is culled from a later date in terms of the James Murphy stuff, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a lot of early stuff, like there's a bit towards the end where him and Nancy Wang are in an apartment and he's like angrily responding on some LCD or DFA forum to somebody about like tour dates, and you're like, wow, okay. And it's like an AOL account or something like that. Oh my God. Looks like that. But yeah, there is loads of footage. Even the Moldy Peaches are at the start of the film are like, come in and be to their neighbors in their apartment block, who look flustered and bewildered.
I thought that was their family. Yeah, they're in like this kind of Upper East Side, like clearly trust fund babies or something. And like, a lot of these bands are rich people, and some of them are very insufferable. But again, they make great music. It's a scattershot enough. I mean, I feel like we're being scattershot, but it's a scattershot enough documentary, isn't it? Like, it just kind of is like, here's New York 2001. Here are these bands that came out of nowhere and immediately they were like successful. I think it
does a good job for me of kind of avoiding the hype cycle and the success train, but while still showing what they were up to, you know, like the Strokes very much early on, and the AES, especially those two bands, actually Interpol as well, all of these bands, you get to see them in their very first beginnings when figuring out who they are, who they want to be. And what I like about the way that the Strokes one is done is, like, there's obviously, it clearly gets bigger because the stages get bigger, the $2 bill, MTV special, all that stuff. It's clearly bigger stages, and that happens and that develops. And I think the way that moves along also, I think there are certain narrative beats to this that work really well. 9/11.
Did you think the 9/11 thing worked well as a narrative beat? I thought it was very jarring.
Well, it places you, I mean, it's fascinating footage.
Of course it is, yeah.
No doubt. But it does place you in that time, because the Strokes came out early 2001, right, wasn't it?
When they broke, yeah.
Yeah, that was when the album came out.
Like, because New York City Cops was taken off the album.
Yeah, so that's what I remember, They were like, well, we can't be seen to say anything bad about the New York police because of 9/11.
We can't say ACAB now. Yeah basically. Yeah.
So
great song though.
yeah, I went back to playing that again, obviously.
the 9/11 thing, because I remember, again, I mean, I don't know about you, but I remember that day very vividly. I remember like sitting at home in my house watching Sky News over and over again. I remember working in a supermarket that night, not quite a toy store, of course, and people were running in like raiding the supermarket like for bread and milk as if like this was going to come to
Ireland.
Oh yeah, I was like, what's going on?
Wow,
not a chance. But like, I mean, again, I was like 17, so. But I think it's more the way in the documentary. No, listen, if you're covering the time period, you have to cover it. But I thought there was a slightly awkward juxtaposition with, here's 9/11 happening and it's the worst thing ever. And also, hey, you know, Julian's sad about that. You know, and
you got, like, Paul Banks specifically.
Sad eye Julian. Yeah, Paul Banks. Yeah, they're all just like Karen, they're all very sad about it. And I'm like, I'm sure they are. But like, it's a bit like, I don't know if the slight ennui of some of these about to be megastars is quite the same.
Yeah. Well, I have to say,
terrorist attack on New York City.
Yeah, like, yeah, no, it's not. But it is. I think it is interesting to see some like Paul Banks in the wreckage in a way, or like covered in ash.
That is a hell of a shot, to be fair. Yeah, he's literally on the streets, like helping people or trying to like clean up.
He's not. He's just looking at things. I think he's like, we're picking up papers, and he's just kind of very glibly like looking for stuff that fell. Or
I didn't realize how low his self esteem was, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah, do you know what?
In general,
they come across as complete fucking nerds.
They do, yeah.
Don't they?
They're not
like,
cool.
At the start, they're like, they look like the spotty teenagers who want to be part of the crew and they don't know how to get into it. And then that's really underscored when they book a tour in England, in the UK, and they book it, what, Easter? And no one turns up for any of the
shows.
All
the student towns are closed, yeah, basically. Yeah,
they play a metal festival. Yeah. It's that was so hilarious. Funny. Yeah.
And then people are like, you know, he said the question everyone kept asking us is, do you guys know the Strokes?
Yeah.
It's brutal.
But he says that he was working in like stuffing envelopes in a university, and he wanted to be part of the scene that where the Strokes were, where they were showing like the coolest guys with the coolest songs. So he was very literally coming from, I want to be part of that scene. It is interesting as well. They look miserable a lot of the time.
But they were clearly fractured in a weird way. Because yeah. I mean, like, obviously, like, you know, Carlos D, their bass player, is there, who eventually would leave the band at a certain point during their run. But you can see right away he's a square peg in a round hole or something. And they're like, when he plays, he's unbelievable, but he's a party animal, and he's clearly like, and he looks like he's in the Misfits or something. Like, he wears makeup and stuff, and they're all kind of sharp suited.
When they're being interviewed, and the most interesting thing about the band is the holster that he's wearing.
he's wearing a gun holster with no gun. But he dresses like a character from like a Robert Rodriguez movie or something. Yeah. And like, Interpol are cool. Like, I mean, like, they do still have that kind of level of, like, it's hard to see Paul Banks as this kind of like, shy, you know. I guess they're all, aren't they all? Julian Casablancas is one of the worst interviewees ever, and I should know, I interviewed him.
Yeah, you have.
It didn't go great. It was all right.
Well, before you get to that, just about Carlos D, I mean, obviously he left the band in 2010, shortly after the end of this film. And he said, and 3 months after Carlos Dengler left Interpol, the band revealed he actually disliked playing his bass guitar. So apparently he didn't want to play it at all.
He's also super good at it, of course, which is a wonderful contradiction.
I know, yeah. When asked if the band missed Dengler during a 2022 Reddit AMA, Banks stated, he was difficult, but not too difficult. Total genius, TBH. So that's
it, they do still get asked about it. And in fact, I not to be Mr. Well, I interviewed, when I watched our interview, I was like, I've actually interviewed a couple of these people, which is weird here and there. Not that many. But I did interview, why is his name escaping me? I fucking interviewed him. Interpol's...
Sam Fogarino.
The other one.
Oh, Daniel Kessler.
Daniel Kessler. I can't believe it. I forgot his name. That's so embarrassing. The incredibly sharp-suited Daniel Kessler. I interviewed him for a side project of his called Big Noble, for Drowned in Sound years ago, and I haven't heard of that side project before or since. He was cool, it was a phone call, but I think I got a Carlos question in, even though I'm like, I know this is old ground, but people keep asking you. I forget what I asked, but like...
People keep asking me to ask you.
One of those things, yeah, you couch it that way where you're like, are you sick of being asked about such and such? But like, for some reason, the Interpol story has that weird... Because like, I guess, I like Interpol, I do. I think they're a good band, but I guess they're a bit boring.
First two albums, great.
Yeah.
Even the first one, though, drags a bit. Antics is brilliant.
Oh, the first one, Turn on the Bright Lights, is the one.
It does. It does. Watch some of the footage, actually. Most of the footage in this film is brilliant.
It is, yeah.
But the some of the Interpol stuff at the start is a bit dour. Like,
they're kind of a dour band.
Yeah, they like, are. Unless they have a decent stage set up, and it just feels a bit like, oh, all right.
Pedestrian, yeah. I saw them at Picnic and they were terrible. I saw them at the Olympia and they were amazing. So it's that kind of thing.
I think I last saw them probably 2004 or 2005 or something like that.
Oh, okay.
At Oxygen, like Antics had come out. It was that time. I think it was Oxygen. I think they played around that time.
They've just become like a solid rock band. I mean, like, I like, they've got some good stuff here and there, and you know, it's fine that they're doing what they do, but it's, you know, it's another Interpol album.
I did cringe a little bit when the whole Napster thing comes up, and I was like, Oh, actually, it's not the Lars Ulrich from Metallica story here.
The same, yeah.
Yeah, they're actually happy enough, the people. I mean, obviously, you remember that time, people could download whatever the fuck they wanted in advance because nearly everything leaked.
Yeah.
And at that point, like, I don't remember Antics, but they talk about somebody coming up into them in the bar and singing the song that they've downloaded in advance 3 months before the album came out.
Yeah.
Like, you just, I mean, that's a bit of cop on. You just don't do that, maybe.
But that was quite the thing. And like, Paul Banks had this look of betrayal on his face, which I really enjoyed. And he was just, he seemed more like just bewildered. And he's like, how could this possibly happen? And there's loads of that. I mean, like, I guess like that happens with the DFA stuff and obviously the Rapture and what LCD becomes. And it's like, I guess there was just no real organization. It was all one big party, unless you're on like Rough Trade or something, which I presume does have. And I'm sure, like, who knows? Maybe I'm just fucking not wildly speculating here. Maybe there were very diligent people working behind the scenes in the label side of things, but stuff really fell through the cracks, right? All these cool people having a great time, but you're like, whenever they tried to get into the business side of things, I'm like, oh yeah, that's, yeah, we have to do that as well, don't we?
Yeah.
Which the documentary kind of flirts at. I will say at this juncture, I think it's a good documentary. I don't think it was amazing. It's very surface level.
I mean, it's totally nostalgic. Like, it's my nostalgia. You know what I mean? Time, like, yeah, it's that time. That's why I really like
it. It's an easy watch. Like, yeah, you know, you're just like, sure. Here you are. It's like an hour 49 or something.
Yeah.
It doesn't, like, I don't know. I mean, I find myself coming away from documentaries often being like, you know, like, it's, you know, once the basic premise is on the table, it's all about how strong are your interviews? How strong is your talking? How strong is your footage? And in this case, you know, any new interviews you get are like new audio interviews spliced in, some of which Karen O's in particular are extremely interesting and insightful, and in some cases kind of alarming. Like, she's very frank.
Yeah,
about
but let's talk about the areas. I mean, the footage, obviously the iconic shots of her crying in the MAPS video is kind of buttresses the film, essentially. It is the start and the end of the film. So, and she, it does kind of take her transformation from quiet person, indie, quiet singer-songwriter to punk rock sneering, you know, front woman.
Female David Bowie, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, what is interesting, I think, and I'm glad it does cover it, because she's like, what she says, there was no code to what I was doing as a woman in rock at that time, which is interesting, because, I mean, I kind of think it's an interesting thing to ponder now that in around 2001, 2002, there was no...
You'd act like the Distillers, the Donnas.
Not many.
Courtney Love is still a thing.
She does talk about dealing with the sensationalism of just, you know, on all the typical being a woman in rock questions.
Like. Yeah, and she also, you know, like paparazzi were taking crotch shots of her as well. And she said that she had to deal with things that none of her bandmates, of course, Nick Sinner and Brian Chase, and also her contemporaries, like the Strokes, she was like, they're going through a thing of their own, of course, but it's not what I'm going through. And she also gets into... You know, she refers to herself as a halfie at one stage because she's half Korean.
Yeah.
And she's like, I'm not white enough for the Korean people. I'm not Korean. I'm not Asian enough for the Koreans. And I'm this kind of hybrid person in between, and I don't know where I go or what I do. And she becomes this exceptional front woman. And just hearing her talk about that and the struggles, like, I thought was quite the juxtaposition in the contrast with the force of nature that she is and how much she is beloved by the fans that she does encounter. Like, there's some people in, like, Scotland who are like... They're the future or whatever. It's fucking rule. And I do remember, I bought that album at the time and I was like, this is like nothing I've ever heard.
Yeah.
How it was produced, how she sounded. And also, like, I mean, Date with the Night, I think straight away you're like, well, that's an unbelievable song. But like, you know, Maps is probably the greatest song ever written.
Like, I mean, this film certainly makes the case for the most important song.
It's Be My Baby by the Ronettes, and it's Maps. You know, it's like they're just they're just unbelievable. Yeah, and like it's a song that you never tire of. It's full of such emotion, and yeah, I came away from it like, you know, like with a kind of not a newfound respect for the AES, but I was like, wow, yeah, like they do rule, and they've had a really interesting journey, and they're still going, and she's done so much, you know, like whether it's, you know, the current iteration of the AES, and even like, you know, the fucking Immigrant Song covered with Trent Reznor for the Girl with Dragon Tattoo, that kind of nightmarish Bond theme. She's with stuff with Danger Mouse. She's kind of like, she did an amazing thing, I think, with Michael Kunuka. She's one of those people who, like, you know, can do anything.
Yeah.
And I wonder if she gets to, like, you know, she's clearly like revered, but like, yeah, it's just wild to see her, like, and then you see her backstage at these shows and she's just kind of curled up into a ball and she's clearly got like a lot of anxiety, and it's, you know, it's very much the classic, I'm super shy over here, but once I'm on stage, I'm a different person. And it seems like she really had to kind of build her own security, build her own kind of support system. Not that the band weren't there for her, but like, she's clearly unmoored from everyone else.
She says they can't relate they don't get any blame necessarily, but... there's certainly some footage where you see she's angry and they're kind of looking at her going, what's wrong?
Yeah.
As if you're being a bit mad.
This is amazing. You should be having, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So there is a fair bit of that. So what do you think about the major section, I guess, is the Strokes, really, because it's the true line, the biggest, kind of the buzziest, hypest kind of story in all of this is the Strokes, right?
I think it's impossible to present new information with the Strokes because they have been one of the most catalogued bands out there since 2001, whether it was NME, whether it was Q, whether it was any American rock magazine, whether it was any television show, they were everywhere. They really, really were. It took me a while to kind of fully get on their wavelength. I liked them, certainly. But it took me a while to really be like, yeah, no, they actually are that good. And I do love them now. I the most recent album is fantastic. And I love their comeback. And I love that they're in the world and that they kind of, you know, became friends again or whatever. And like, you know, they've had a hell of a run with that kind of stuff. And like, it's Albert Hammond Jr. like could very well have gone in a much different way, and Ryan Adams definitely takes some of the blame for that, I think.
He's certainly the villain of the piece
in many respects. Yeah,
the trickster who lives down the road across the way with the bag of drugs and the "I listen to your songs, Albert."
I will say, I mean, it seems Albert Hammond Jr. clearly had his own insecurities in that regard. Yeah, he was saying that he could, like, the other guys didn't care about his own music, and therefore he was like, yeah, so Ryan Adams was his enabler, who also happened to have a bag of heroin with him or whatever. But, like, the Strokes, I mean, to go back to your original question, I mean, like, a lot of this as well, I mean, like, if you're like you and me and lots of others who will be drawn to this documentary, it'll be, well, I know a lot of this already. I'm very familiar, and I've read the fucking book, and that book, to be fair, did have new information in it when it came out. Lizzie Goodwin's book, there was lots of, like, oh my god, wow. Julian Casablancas is being extremely forthcoming here, and he's talking about stuff I didn't even know about, including the Ryan Adams stuff, where he was like, you know, he's like, I told that guy I was going to kick the shit out of him if he didn't leave Albert alone, kind of thing. And so in that regard, it's great. That's why an oral history can be really, really good, because I don't know how you feel about this, because, like, you know, when you do interviews, I know most stuff you do is podcast-wise, but you've done written stuff as well, of course. But I mean, like, it's that kind of weird contradiction where, you know, I've interviewed XYZ, you've interviewed XYZ, but it's like, I love reading a transcript. I much prefer reading a Q&A. Oh, yeah. Like, for example, if tomorrow it's like Trent Reznor, new interview, I'm like, I want that to be a Q&A.
Yeah.
And therefore, when you write a Q&A as a journalist, you know, transcribing the interview that you've done, that is part of the work. But if you're like, I'll just stop and tell this and here's the Q&A, I always felt like I was being lazy or something. It's got to be a narrative.
Yeah.
You know, but like, that's...
Well, certainly it's something that, when writers have asked me for advice, I say don't write Q&As because you don't get a good impression of some of your writing then.
I agree with that.
As no, if you're an early writer.
I fully agree with that. But I will say that, like, my own greediness is I want to kind of read every word. If you're like, I spoke to David Hammond for 6 hours, I'm like, I want to read the whole thing. I'm sure a lot of it could be 6 hours, a long time. Yeah. But, you know, it's like, I just want to see what was said with as little cleanup as possible. And so I think that the book of Meet Me in the Bathroom is extremely good for that, because while I'm sure, as is the New York house style, you know, this interview has been edited and condensed for clarity, although maybe not in that book because it's like 900 pages long. But I do love when you're like, let that person talk. Like I want to hear what Albert Hammond Jr. has to say about this. The film, I think, in terms of the Strokes, through its archive footage, does a good job with that as well. But the problem with the Strokes, if there is a problem with the Strokes, is that they are the shyest people. They just don't fucking say anything.
Yeah, and I think the interviews here do highlight that, because you're like...
during the headlight stuff, like...
Yeah, it's like, Nikolai, help me out here.
Yeah, that was like, hilarious. Yeah.
Loads of that.
Like, well, like, what do you want me to say?
Yeah, yeah. Like, he's been... I mean, one of the things that the film does talk about and does, you know, present in terms of an important story in The Strokes is his background, Julian's background, his dad... in a model agency, owned a model agency, and he was kind of co-opted into it early and then felt a bit weird about it and then didn't. And then apparently was like, I'm not going to be involved in this. But then when the band became well known, he was like, oh, this is what I didn't want. The being famous thing. But like,
they're rich kids who met in Switzerland at a boarding school. That's how it happened. Also, I love the bit when Nardwar is interviewing them.
Yeah.
It's the funniest thing.
I don't remember Nardwar being so snarky, like, in that
That's
way.
That's kind of his thing, though.
But like, is he not, like, it was a bit mean or something.
Yeah, he's really put, he's like, you guys met in Switzerland, right? At a very expensive school, wasn't it? And they're kind of like looking at each other.
Yeah.
And we've all had those interviews, I'm sure, where like...
Elite models.
You've interviewed someone and they might not be on for whatever reason, or maybe you're at fault. And therefore, yeah, a transcript in that situation can be very difficult, and you have to write around it, as they say. Yeah. And with the Strokes, I'm like, I found myself being like, fuck, okay, they're giving this guy nothing. They've just finished Room on Fire recording it. And he's like, how do you feel about the album? And like, they're kind of like,
literally finished it today.
And that's the end of that sentence. And then they're like, we don't want to let people down. And I'm like, okay. And I'm like, okay, so I guess my opening sentence is, we don't want to let people down. And I'll write a massive paragraph profiling them, and I'll throw in a few, because I'm only going to get, like, yeah, it's a tricky one. They, for a band that have such charisma in what they do musically, and how they look, and the videos, and on stage, to not have that in an interview situation, I think is funny, but also not uncommon. I mean, like, it's not a prerequisite. Like, a rock band doesn't need to be good at interviews. It's frustrating for fucking people like you and me, and maybe a fan who wants to see a cool interview. But it is funny to be like, that's the Strokes. That's the Strokes in 2001. And they're so awkward. Like, what the fuck?
You mean like their manager, who somebody calls a little boy or a little child or something at some point, is like, has more to say a lot of the time, even the little bits that he's in.
But what do you think? I mean, do you think that they are, in fact, the rock band of the last 20 years? Like,
certainly the American rock band, probably. I mean, other than the Arctic Monkeys. Yeah, probably. Probably are. And I think they're...
Your beloved, the 1975, of course. You've come around a little bit on them.
Yeah, I have.
Andrea's influence.
Then it just makes it more... awkward when he starts doing more questionable things again.
It's a rock star for you.
Problematic favorites. Here we go. No, but at least, I mean, with the Strokes, I think the music stands for themselves. And even a few years ago, they still feel relevant.
Definitely.
Because they have still been, they're still releasing good albums. Where for me, Interpol and the AAS to a lesser extent, I like some of their stuff that they've done recently, but it's been diminishing returns for me personally.
I think that's fair. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to, you know, have a consistent level of quality. I think the Strokes kind of imploding helped them, if anything.
Yeah.
And it had to happen. Like, they were set up so hard.
Well, that is the bit in the film where it's like, well, you are set up to fail because the expectation is too high and you don't sell enough records. You sell a shitload of records.
What was it, like 650,000 copies on the second
650,000, yeah.
And they're like, that's a failure. It's supposed to be millions.
Yeah.
And they're like, okay.
Yeah, just the way it is. But that's... You know, in a way, we don't have that anymore. We don't have those notches anymore because there's no such thing as massive album sales anymore. So we can't have those.
Even magazine covers don't mean as much as they used to. Like, I mean, and again, I think about the Strokes, and I think about the music first, of course, but I do think about the photographs. I think about the copies of Q and Enemy that I would have seen around in newsagents or in my own fucking room. You know what I mean? It's just like, it was synonymous with the time. Physical media was so synonymous with that time. And even like getting these glimpses, MTV2, like watching music channels, you know, that was like, it's such a different thing now.
Well, it's a shared narrative of, you know, limited amount of media that we had. And now it's fractured so much that you're like, well, doesn't matter anymore. Maybe.
Yeah. But. Yeah. We're really teetering on the tightrope here of like, oh, you know, back in my day.
Back in my day.
All this were fields.
Well, back in my day, Courtney Love was given a 24-hour MTV live stream where she was clearly off her face and brought in Albert Hammond Jr. and Ryan Adams,
who were clearly off their faces.
Who spend some of the live broadcast in bed asleep.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the Strokes were, I guess, like turned on the television. We're like, what's happening?
Yeah, pretty jarring that stuff. Seeing that, but also I love that bit. Like going back to what like Julian's Casablanca's uncomfortableness with fame and. These literal, like, two very famous people, Winona Ryder and Courtney Love, coming over to him and be like, come be famous with us. Come be famous with us, Julian. And he's like, no.
That's so funny. And to be fair, like, you know, to give the Moldy Peaches their due, it is Kimya Dawson, I think, who is regaling that anecdote. And she's kind of like, she's like, yeah, she's like, that was just the weirdest shit ever. You know, I didn't exist in that moment. And here come these two super famous people literally saying, as you just said, come be famous with us. And I thought it was going to be, and that's the last time I saw Julian Casablancas. And I was glad that she was like, and he didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
Because he was like, no, I can't. I'm really fucking weird. Like,
but I think they did. They did.
Like, well, they did drift. Yeah, 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 yeah.
They did drift apart.
Naturally. Well, I mean, maybe he realized that. Maybe he listened to the Moldy Peaches.
Finally. I must get around to the Moldy Peaches.
And he's like, oh, gee, really? This is who we have on tour with? Get that child manager.
It is good to have her perspective of the Mythical England tour.
That was good.
Yeah.
That was cool.
She's like, Why don't you want to be like, why maybe don't drink so much? Because don't you want to remember this? And they're like, nope.
That was a hell of a perspective, wasn't it? I was just like, wow, that's like really wise and sensible. But also if you're in that moment and you're young and you're like in another country, it's got to be really hard not to just go fucking blitz, right? I mean, like,
yeah,
but no, sure. I will say, I read.
And you're signed to Rough Trade and everyone's talking about you.
Yeah. I thought him, like, from my Moldy Peaches problems, I did think Kimya Dawson was actually a very good anchor in the documentary. I thought she was actually, her perspective was very interesting, and she is charismatic, you know, and she seems very winning, and, you know, I
good karaoke singer.
Good karaoke singer, yeah. But also, but you are a singer. Like, you know, you are a professional singer. Like, you have to be able to do, you know, like, it should be a given that you're, you know, this is Jessie J on that talent show all over again, you know?
Oh, God. Right. Right. So we get on talking about LCD Senses when the James Murphy conundrum.
Listen, I'm just going to sit back and watch you go.
Well, on last week's episode, I literally talked to David Holmes about his album, Let's Get Killed. And around that time, so that's 1997. So he was hanging around New York and he was hanging around DFA. He was hanging around Tim Goldsworthy and James Murphy. And there's some great quotes that come out of that time. First of all, David Holmes did what he wanted. He was playing techno or wherever else he was playing around the world. He was playing in New York a lot. There was very much an Irish scene in New York as well. A collection of people like Marcus Lampkin of Shit Robot, who ended up on DFA Records and very instrumental to the DFA story. But David Holmes got involved with the DFA engineers originally, the two lads, James Murphy and Tim Goldsworthy. And I love the friction between the two of them. It's brilliant. And it's in the book as well. And it's just underscored here beautifully. There's a part where he's just like, so David Holmes is like, I want to make a record like Can, because David Holmes is just a producer and a DJ. And he's like, I don't play an instrument. The studio is my instrument. That's what he says. And to James Murphy, this is absolutely the worst thing anyone could possibly ever say, because he's like, what, you want to be Can? He's so angry about it. He's like, Can lived blah blah blah, they practice 8 hours a day, they lived in the palace and all this shit.
Yeah, castle, like, or a museum or something.
A castle in Switzerland or something. And they were in some sort of contemporary music school and all this shit. Yeah, you can't just stamp your way.
They're the best of the best, like when it comes to like what they do and like classical musicianship and such. And he's like, that's not us.
Yeah. So there's a lot of rubbing of egos there, and different sensibilities more than anything else. But he, James Murphy also says that LCD and DFA wouldn't happen without David Holmes, which is, I did ask him about last week. He wasn't very forthcoming. If you go back and hear it, he's fairly Teflon answer in terms of.
Yeah, he gave you the.
It is what it is.
Yeah, the politician answer. Yeah. But hang on, so the LCD Sound System story, I guess, you know, as well documented, but for anyone who doesn't know, it's basically that James Murphy was like, fuck this, I'm going to do it.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. That was it. I mean, I think the thing is, James Murphy is self-aware enough to know that he's a bit of a perfectionist, bit of a prick. And that works for a lot of his music and his musical choice that he's made. But it also probably rubbed people up the long way. And like, as a studio and engineer who's like, says he knows everything and says he knows the proper way to do things. So that's what happens with, you know, the Rapture, when it comes to the Rapture, because they make this record with the Rapture, and it brings together disco and punk. And you're nobody's ever done this before. But they kind of sit on it for a while because they don't have the business heads on them to find the distribution for the record. And there is really good footage of the Rapture looking really pissed off in an interview.
Yeah, Luke Jenner, the frontman.
Yeah, he's like, when is the album coming out? And he's real like he's got a sour face on.
They're deflated, yeah.
Chewing Wasps. He's like really annoyed.
And we've been playing these songs for a year.
A year and a half.
We can't put, that long, fuck me. I mean, and they were an interesting case as well, because I remember seeing them in NME, Luke Jenner with his massive hair. And it was like, it's the Disco Strokes. And I was really glad to hear him use that phrase in this documentary when he talks about it as well. He goes, yeah, we're the Disco Strokes, apparently. Because, again, Clang, I interviewed Luke Jenner years ago at a French music festival. And I was chatting to him. And, of course, I brought up the whole thing. And I was like, I remember when, like, you know, the whole buzz around when you guys signed or whatever, you know. I was like, it's the new Strokes. And he was like, Disco Strokes. He's like, we were the Disco Strokes. And he was like, he goes, $1 million deal. He goes, never happened again. No one ever got $1 million deal after us. I don't know if that's true, but it was a good line. He actually was very sweet and interesting to talk to. But they're a good band. And it was just this weird thing where like James Murphy and Tim Goldsworthy saw them play live. And it was classic. It was like, them. We have to work with them. Let's fucking sign them. They're going to be our first act. It's going to be amazing. And it seems like it was all working.
Yeah.
But then the admin got in the way again. And James Murphy was just like, they had to like leave him.
Yeah.
And I guess he gave them the music, which I found surprising.
Yeah. He must have given them everything because, I mean, he understood where they were coming from.
Because that album did come out.
Like, yeah. He was holding their career back. I think did they signed to Universal then after that?
They signed to someone. Yeah. That must be when they got the $1 million deal. Because, enough hype, I guess, had been built. Yeah. It was one of the big ones. Anyway. And yeah, Echoes comes out. I do remember
trying to download that.
Yeah, you're just as bad as the guy who downloaded the Antics album 3 months early. No,
hey, listen, you are. I was waiting a year and a half for that album to come out.
Yeah, it's James Murphy's fault, in fairness.
Yeah, but I mean, he is responsible for some of the best moments in this film for me personally. The haircuts from his early days, for sure.
Not a man who likes a hairbrush. Yeah.
No, not at all. And then I love the part, which it does explain, it like explains the origin story of the dance and rock together, with where he is at the David Holmes like DJ set with all his pals, and he spent a couple of weeks or a couple of months, whatever, every time someone's taken a pill, he's like, how's it feel now,
studying them,
how's it feel now. Yeah. So in the film he says, David Holmes says, and Tim Goldsworthy, we both say actually, that he got clearance from his therapist to try it, which is so good.
Phenomenal.
But it just sums up the kind of person he is.
And
of course, you know who that therapist is?
No.
The guy who in Someone Great, the guy from Someone Great.
No
The subject of Someone Great. Yeah.
Are you serious?
That song is about his therapist.
Yeah. I should have known this. I didn't know this. I was hoping it would be like Rick Rubin or something. I am going to, at my next therapy session, which will be this weekend when this podcast comes out, I'm just for the laugh, just see how he reacts. And I've got a good relationship with my therapist. I might just be like, do I have your permission to take drugs? I'm supposed to see what he says.
I mean, very good. And I love the fact, like, James is just like, okay, he's been asking how it is, how it feels. He's got permission from his therapist. He goes out and he buys 20 packs of Juicy Fruit chewing gum because he heard the people chew their jaw off themselves. And then David Holmes is given the signal and he drops Tomorrow Never Knows by the Beatles. And you're like, yeah.
And okay, there's footage is there footage of that exact moment?
I don't know where that footage comes from.
Because there's footage of him dancing and looking like he is taking drugs for the first time and having this epiphany moment. But also, a few people, and like the book, I think much more so, but a few people have said that they think that this is a hit piece on James Murphy. Do you think it is?
No, I don't think so.
I didn't think it was that bad. I was kind of like, he comes across like a little bit of a clown. I think
there's some conflict there, and that's the issue. Because there's people that actually hate him, and there's people that he hates. Because he rubs people up the wrong way, clearly. He knows his sheer bloody-mindedness rubs people up the wrong way, but it also is what creates Losing My Edge, for example, which is the first single that they ever did, which Tim Goldsworthy goes, don't release this, I fucking hate this.
He basically is like, you'll embarrass yourself. Yeah. I think that song fucking rules. Well, and I know it's the most ironic song, but I love it. Yeah, it's amazing.
But funny enough, the thing that David Holmes or the James and David Holmes rub up against, which is the, like, you can't just sample your way to a hit or to what you want to do, he essentially does that on Losing My Edge by taking or paraphrasing, interpolating Killing Joke's song Change as that song. So he's obviously changed his mind. Maybe the drugs loosen him up a bit. He's like, yeah, fuck it, I'll do whatever I want.
It's also, he got pissed off because the whole thing is like, he talks about how, again, it's Napster adjacent, because it's like, he was out in a club or something and he heard XYZ that he normally plays. And he's like, wait a minute. He's like, I've spent years and a lot of money buying those records, tracking those physical records down to play at my shows. And there's some kid over there with a laptop. How the fuck? And apparently he's like, where did you get this? And the guy was like, off the internet, man.
Yeah.
So he rebelled against that. He was like, that's not on. So that's where Losing My Edge comes from as well. Or at least that's how the film tells it. So there's a righteous anger in that song about, like, you know, and like, you know, the whole thing of starting a band in his mid to late 30s. I think Nancy Wang is like, we're starting a band in our mid to late 30s.
Who does that? That's absurd.
But to be fair, and like, look, LCD, you know, I wouldn't even say I've got a love-hate relationship with them. I thought the last album was muck, but I saw them on tour. I thought that was an astonishing show.
Yeah, they're great live.
I prefer them being in the world, even if, yeah, okay, now he's doing a fucking NFT yacht thing or whatever. Whatever. It's like, I'd rather James Murphy out there doing things than not out there doing things.
Yeah, yeah. And it is. I mean, deciding to start a band in your 30s is absurd. And it's also, it must have given him freedom and given everyone else in the band. Like, he describes Nancy Wang as his drinking buddy.
Mm.
That's all. Like, I mean, she was in the Wan McLean, who released stuff on his label.
They got some great stuff.
Yeah. And there's loads of other, there's a few other acts on DFA, like Holy Ghost, for example, who did quite really good stuff and just aren't in the story. I understand why they're not in this story at all. But I think the kind of, that flashpoint of like, I've just had enough of being, I know I'm right, I'm just gonna do it myself.
But like, in fairness, look what it led to. I'm like, do I love every LCD Sense song? No. But are they like one of the most, you know, interesting acts, or at least successful in a way? Yeah. I mean, like, they have a place in fucking history. I'm dancing around the word iconic here because I hate that word.
Yeah, like, they're one of my favorite bands. Yeah, there's no doubt about it.
Do you appreciate his prickishness? Like, is that part of the cocktail for you? Like, is that like?
Well, I mean, it's something that when I found out he was, I was like, it makes sense.
Mm.
It explains a lot. Explains a lot about his obsession with fidelity, his obsession with coffee and natural wine and all of the things that make LCD what it is, because he's just like, well, I'm just gonna play everything, because that's what the recordings are. He does everything.
Yeah,
he brings in the band, but the band really make it sing for me. And like, live, I saw them last summer, Brixton Academy, one of those reunion shows, one of those residency shows. It was incredible. It was so good.
I remember on my podcast, Niall, that we haven't talked about. How dare you?
No, oh, sorry. Well, your repetitive procedure. It's been in the show notes for a while.
The No Encore podcast.
The No Encore podcast.
Ages ago on that show.
Dave Hanratty's No Encore podcast.
That's me. That's me. I'm a jerk. But years ago, Mick Pope.
I'll drop it in.
Speaking of jerks, no, I love Mick. Mick Pope was on No Encore years ago. And I remember him talking about the Galaxy played whatever picnic that was, and LCD were on it. You must know you were there, LCD playing picnic the last time.
Yeah, yeah.
During the main stage,
Main stage, yeah.
I wasn't there. And I remember Mick saying that, because I think he had a similar kind of conflicted journey with this band. And I think he was like, he said, oh, look, you know, he headed down after the Galaxy set or whatever. Maybe they overlapped a little bit, but he said he went down and he's like, I'll check it out, you know, whatever. I don't like that new album or whatever happened at the time. And he was kind of like, yeah, you know, it's fine. Yeah, it's grand. Like, you know, yeah, this is, you know, I'm getting that nostalgia rush and the dopamine hits, but, you know, it's all very whatever. And he said that by the end of like New York, I Love You, you know, You're Bringing Me Down, Mick was like, don't ever end. Like, he's fully like just like subsumed into it. And I remember seeing them on that American Dream tour in the Olympia, and they played like a 2-hour show. And I kind of was like, oh, you know, good luck, LCD Sound System, trying to impress me. And like, again, by the end of it, I was like, this is one of the greatest things I've ever experienced. Like, I think
that's the attention to detail that somebody like James Murphy brings to things. Where for me, what I love about an LCD show is how they set up. They don't set up like a regular band. They set up like they're in a studio.
Yeah, yeah.
They set up around each other awkwardly. It doesn't make sense. Obviously, a huge disco ball always helps. And they do a great thing where like it's like a disco ball drop during Get Innocuous. And it's so good.
Yeah, yeah.
So much fun.
I'm just
Us
like,
versus Them, actually. Us versus Them.
Even thinking now, I'm like, really, oh, God, I need to see them again.
Yeah.
I need to see them.
But that's
it. Again.
They're like one of my favorite bands to see. And even though, yeah, they have a few duds here and there, but like, overall, the intention is sustains itself for me. I think.
I know I'm splitting out documentary for just a second. I'll go back to it. But like, do we know the current state of play with Tim Galsworthy and him? Are they just?
They're not friends.
Forever done. Like,
there was a story about last year about James being an arsehole again to a fellow to one of the DFA co-founders or something, or somebody, Jonathan Galkin, who now started a new label called 4/4 Records. He followed me on Twitter last week.
Wow.
So I'm like, okay, he's out on his own now, but he something about being locked out of the studio and stuff like that.
Wonderful.
Not being able to pick up his thing. It was all very public on Pitchfork and in interviews.
But on the documentary, like I kind of went into it like almost expecting, like, and even hearing they're like, oh, it's a real fucking drive-by on James Murphy, and I was like, eh, I think the book is the bigger drive-by.
Yeah.
If anything, I mean, you know?
I mean, you should watch Shut Up and Play the Hits, because he's not the nicest person.
No.
And he's weary in himself about everything, and he overthinks everything, and that's fine. But that makes great for great art, but it also makes sometimes that he means he's actually an arsehole to everybody and some people. So
did you, like, book versus film for a second, did you feel like I was like, I know that you're covering the same scene and the same time and, you know, but you've new footage and you've new interviews. I'm like, I don't know if you need to call Mimi in the bathroom. Like, it felt very disconnected.
There are some, I did look back at the book this week, and there are some direct.
There are. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I haven't read it since it
came
out.
That whole David Holmes, James Murphy doing drugs section is
full on
word for word.
Yeah. And like, in fairness, like it does say at the end, based on the book by Lizzie Goodman, I'm sure she gave the nod, but I just found myself being like, this could just be another documentary about the scene. Like, you know, and also like for a book that begins with like such a lengthy background on the band Jonathan Fireeater and how that led to the Walkmen, neither of those bands get mentioned once in this documentary. Vampire Weekend don't get mentioned.
Yeah, the National maybe less expected to be, but I mean, they are a New York band.
I guess it's just, you know, we can only focus on so many, but like I felt that it was, and maybe that's a good thing, like it feels like a companion piece.
If you try and do everything, you just end up doing nothing, you know. So I think it does enough. I mean, it's meaty enough with those main bands, the Moldy Peaches, of course. Interpol, the Strokes, LCD, and Ryan Adams. Every hero needs a villain. So
it kind of runs out of steam as well. It kind of just like, it's like, and that's it, everyone.
The film finishes with the gentrification of Brooklyn, which, you know, I remember going there around 2007 and going around being in Brooklyn, hearing about it. It was that buzzy time where loads of films were shot there, and it was like, what is this place like? And It was cool. It was nice. But it was also run down. And I remember seeing Alex Turner hanging around, you know,
oh, wow,
on the street. You're like, oh yeah, this is like full of cool people. All right, I get it. But yeah, I mean, that's what happens. These old places. I know I've listened to a podcast with Lizzie Goodman, actually, just in preparation for this. And she was talking about how Dave Satek from TV on the Radio, he lived there in Brooklyn his entire life. And he lived there with his studio was there. And he lived there because it was so cheap. He said he no longer lives there because his studio is now a Gap store. So,
oh, Jesus.
So that's where we're at now in terms of, but that's a natural end to things.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I think the only other thing that I noticed in the film, which was interesting to me, but and it makes more sense because it's a kind of nerd, music nerd that James Murphy is. He's the only one in the film who really talks about his influences or any kind of music making or songwriting or anything like that. Nobody else really discusses that in the film. So just an interesting point to note. But yeah, I mean, I guess the film has to end at the time it does. There is no end point to a scene, really, is there? Like, I mean, it lasted for a long time if you're looking at it that way. Those bands have sustained themselves pretty well. Is there anything the film misses?
Well, I think aforementioned acts like Jonathan Fire during the Walkman, especially because the book was so, I guess, just like foundational with how it approached them. And I did like when Vampire Weekend turned up in the book because it was so funny because they came along when it's like, here's the Strokes being dicks. Here's James Murphy being an asshole. And then here's Vampire Weekend being like, hello, we're shy and awkward. And do you mind if we join in and, you know, like play some songs and stuff? And it's just bizarrely wholesome contrast.
Yeah.
Did it miss anything? I don't know. I mean, like it's a tough one because look, I've never made a fucking documentary. I'd love to, of course, but I don't know. I wouldn't know the first place to start. And so, you know, a lot of work goes into this kind of stuff. The archival footage is such a huge element to it. I mean, I didn't miss the fact that, you know, there was no like, let's cut to Talking Head in their house, which we get a million times, which I'm fine with. I have nothing against that concept. And I did think that actually the use of audio over archival footage, while not necessarily just doing the as if Capadia thing, I thought it was quite effective. Did it miss anything? No, I don't think it's fair to say that it missed anything. Not that you're saying that, but like, I think it's more that like at a certain point, you can't help but be confronted by the fact that all of this was glamour. All of this was magic. All of this was so of a time, and your nostalgia will obviously train your brain to perceive this in a certain way. Even now, watching it 20 years later, you can't help but look back on those times and who you were as a person and how it all felt so much more innocent. That's a natural kind of, I think, not a problem, but it's a natural kind of point that you will arrive at watching this. And at a certain point, it does wear off. You do find yourself going, well, you know, that was then, this is now, I am older, yada, yada. And so end credits, you know, it's like, I think it's admirable. I think it is surface level, though. But also, you know, I'm not sure what else I would have done with it.
Yeah.
And I kind of thought that's how it would be. The book was the same. Yeah, the book was the same. I was like, this is a good book. I'm enjoying it. But at a certain point, you have said all you can say.
Yeah. I mean, the Meet Me in the Bathroom and the scene and the New York scene is part of, you know, we talked last year. I had Louise McSherry on the podcast. Myself and Andrea had Louise McSherry on the podcast to talk about
Indie Sleaze. Yeah, yeah.
Which is like a wider Venn diagram of what this is, because it's like that encompasses the online nature of music fandom at that time, whether it's like people like myself and blogs, and like you said, the people in that book in the modern
age. You're much cooler than Lizzie Goodman's friends and all. No, please. Don't think that was a shot.
Hey, Maggie Rogers edited Meet Me in the Bathroom as well, didn't she, as an intern?
Oh, she did, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've interviewed her as well, so there you go. But no. The Northern Nine has always been a separate, you know.
Yeah.
The Northern Nine, the Nine of Snails.
But no, I mean, the Indie Sleeves thing, and there is, I think that is an interesting to ponder as well. Just, you know, the idea of we're all consuming the photographs of parties in Brooklyn and LA and all that kind of stuff. It's a wider part of which obviously the film doesn't need to cover, but I have been thinking about it a lot because, spoiler alert, I am going to put on some sort of Indie Sleaze Night in the Workman's Cellar.
Holy shit.
On April 7th, Good Friday, I'm putting one on.
I'm absolutely there. Because I was just going to say, like, I mean, I was never cool enough for these parties, and like, you know, you look at it from not only just thousands of miles away, but you're like, there's no fucking way I'd be cool enough to hang out with the Strokes and yeahs, even in their infancy.
Yeah.
So you did it from afar. So yeah, and it is like, you know, like, the whole thing is couched in a certain level of the self and, you know, the wider pop culture thing. And like, it was such an escape, I think, as well, for even like for fucking, you know, me and Drogheda, like, you know, just buying the magazines every week and listening to these albums and such. And then finally also going back and appreciating them slightly later than when I should have, quote unquote, you know.
It's like we had antics in Crawdad years and the club night, but I didn't go that much because we weren't really into that exactly at that point. And my friends weren't, you know what I mean? So like I'd heard about it. Maybe I was even a bit older.
It was a Italo disco only for you.
No, not then. But Dave Hanratty of the No Encore podcast.
That's me.
You are, by the time this episode is out, you will have an episode touching on some of this.
Yeah, that's right. If you have never heard the No Encore podcast, please listen to it.
How the fuck is that possible?
I'm sure it's very possible. I'm sure lots of people
Not with our listenership.
Maybe not, yeah. Niall, of course, was on the show not so long ago. We did a quiz.
Oh, you had to bring it up.
It was a lot of fun. You're welcome back anytime, of course. Now, yes, I think when this comes out...
Didn't have my Weetabix that morning.
You're very close. The current episode of No Encore that should be out by the time this comes out is top five songs from 2001, best and worst. So that's in honor of this documentary and on this podcast as well. So... Yeah, if you've never heard the No Encore show, it's usually a weekly show. It'll be changing in the near future because I'm still kind of figuring out what I'm doing with it. But, you know, it's a regular enough show and it's full of top five themed things and a lighthearted look at the music news of the world and all kinds of in-jokes and such. So, and yeah, listen, you know, as from one podcast rival to another, it's nice to break bread here.
Yeah.
You know?
This isn't your first time on the podcast.
No, but it's a slightly less chaotic time than the last time. So.
Sorry about that. We had a special guest. The only special guest we have is a cat who's on top of the record player. Has been record bag up here.
Shockingly well behaved considering what I thought was going to happen when the cat climbed over me en route to the top of those lovely shelves of yours with your vinyl everywhere.
Boo was into you. He was into you. He had a sniff of you.
What can I say? thank you very much for having me. It's been an awful lot of fun. I think if you've any connection whatsoever to this music scene or even any vague interest in it, it's a perfectly good documentary for that. It's not going to change your life. It's no Metallica, some kind of monster. It's no Bros After the Screaming Stops.
Look, what is?
I think both of those are still on Netflix, by the way. But it's good. Like it was fine. I mean, also, yeah, sorry. You saw it in the cinema. I was supposed to go. I was the one who pulled out the Discord thing last minute because I'm a terrible person. But
yes, you are.
What was it like in the cinema?
That was actually great. I mean, the sound was good, really good. And, it was Lighthouse Screen 1. It doesn't get much better than that for me, really.
All right. Free passes for life there, yeah.
I mean, I haven't had some bad experiences in cinemas recently.
Have you?
Yeah, I told you about my screen cinema, or my Savoy cinema one.
Remind
experience
me.
With Tar. I don't want to say don't go to the Savoy, but if you are going to go to the Savoy, be aware that they have very bright LED lights and creaky noises, creaky seats. In my experience, dark screens and poor sound. So all the things you don't really want when you go to cinema.
That is no disrespect to the Savoy. I will now take you apart piece by piece. Yeah, I've had some fucked up experience in the cinema, but it's an adventure every time. So.
Yeah, it certainly is. It certainly is. Well, that was Meet Me in the Bathroom. Yeah, like I said, hasn't been announced yet, but it maybe will by the time you hear this. Doing an indie sleaze night in Workman's on Good Friday for the crack. I feel like Good Friday is a good night for the people of the age group that I'm who want to have a hangover on a Saturday and still want to be okay for the Monday.
So sorry, can I ask what this entails? I assume great music, but
we'll be playing music of the era from New York and indie rock and indie of the time, but also kind of some of the remix stuff that you would have heard around that time. So the Blog House stuff, even like we're talking like Cut Copy and A-Track and some of that stuff as well. There's loads of bits in there.
Will you play, because this will have featured on the No Encore episode at some point, will you play the incredible mashup of Genie in a Bottle by Christina Aguilera?
Oh, do you know what?
Hard to Explain by the Strokes.
I downloaded that very recently.
Oh, it's the best.
And I have been priming that for playing at some point.
Phenomenal.
Yeah. So,
we play Lose My Edge? Will Lose My Edge get a spin?
Oh, you'll have to, yeah. Like, we're talking TV on the Radio, Rapture, Interpol, all the stuff that's in the film. Bit of New Young Pony Club, I'm sure. Hot Chip, MIA, The Hives.
This is going to fucking
Vampire
rule.
Vampire Weekend. Mieke Snow?
Yes, Animal?
Yes, yeah. Animal. Yeah, yeah, a few of them, maybe. Anyway, there were some things I wrote down. Mastercraft, who did a lot of remixes around that time. And some of them I still listen to. And The Kills as well. Do you remember The Kills?
Yeah, they were the hip cool band with...
They were too cool.
Yeah. Who was in that? It's not... Kate Moss. No. Is it?
No, but the guy was married or went out with
maybe
Kate Moss,
yeah,
I think
yeah.
It was.
They were too cool for me.
Yeah.
Too cool
yeah.
for me.
Well, that's the Indie Sleaze Night. That's Good Friday, April 7th at the Workman's Cellar. Tickets will be on Eventbrite anyway. So I'll there'll be more details about that, hopefully, by the time this is out. Maybe not, but if not, you'll find it on 909.com. Dave Hanratty, thanks so much for coming in. And good to have you in the gaff as
yeah,
well.
Thank you. I love
go
this.
Listen to No Encore. He's always very good at... Dave is always very good at shouting us out. I'm less good at it, but
it's okay.
You're literally in the room.
It's all right. So, you know, no, I don't keep a record of these things.
Ah, you do.
Yeah, thank you. If 909 was a 2001 era New York band pod, like who is the equivalent? Like are you? Who am I to you? And like am I? You know, am I more Interpol? You know, kind of fastidious and shy.
I'd probably be the nerdy James Murphy. That's why maybe I identify with him. Maybe.
Can I be TV on the radio?
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah. Because everyone likes TV on the radio. Yeah. And they didn't piss anyone off.
Hey. I once
had Kit Malone stay in my apartment.
No fucking way.
Yeah.
How did we not open with that?
I completely forgot.
What was that like?
Do you remember when the ash cloud happened?
Yeah. I was supposed to see LCC Sensism in Tripod and they cancelled. Yeah.
So they canceled. And I think TV on the radio were supposed to be sporting.
At that gig?
Yeah. But they that were already. It wasn't TV on the radio. It was Kit Malone's band Rain Machine. Right, so Rain Machine were on tour in Europe and they came to Dublin, and at the time State Magazine was gone, right? And there was a night in the Mercantile that happened, and somehow, I know this happened. We had a night of free bands. I think the likes of the Cast of Cheers maybe around that time was happening. And I went to see Rain Machine in Whelan's, I believe, right? And they had a full band and everything. And I met Kip Malone at South by Southwest briefly, and then I met him again, and I don't know why, but I remember what happened. Right, so Whelan's happens.
Watching a man unfurl in front of me here, this is great.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember everything. Whelan's happens, they played a gig in Whelan's, and the ash cloud happens like that day, and they're like, we don't know what we're going to do. So myself and my partner at the time had an apartment in Smithfield, and we were like, why don't we just invite the band over for dinner so they can hang out? Because at that time we were like, bands are on tour, never get to hang out in an apartment or somebody's, whatever, their friend's place. And they're nice to feel grounded, all this stuff. And they knew they were going to be here for a few days. So we invited them over, made them dinner. And it was like four of the band maybe. And had a nice night with them. Just like very, very innocent, nothing mad. Maybe went to the pub, something like that. And then as part of that, we had one of those gigs in the Mercantile where it was like, do you want to come play a few tunes? And he totally did. He was like, yeah, sure. He played like 8 songs. Just him on his guitar. So, and then I met him at South by Southwest the following year on the street. And the only thing I remember was I was eating a fish po' boy because it was late after seeing all the bands. It was late and he was walking home from where he was staying. And I remember him telling me about Sharon Van Etten. He's like, my friend Sharon Van Etten, you should check her out. I was like, sure I will. And then I completely forgot about it until maybe 2 or 3 years later. I was like, oh, does somebody call Sharon Van Etten that I've heard about recently? Heard about this name before. So anyway, that's my Kip Malone.
Yeah, your connection to this scene runs deeper than any of us could have thought.
Unfortunately, not enough TV on the radio. Great band.
Phenomenal.
I must go back and listen to that.
Phenomenal. Listen to Dear Science, everybody, if
Dear
you never
Science.
Have. Yeah. And also Return to Cookie Mountain. They're a phenomenal band. They're great.
They are indeed.
All right, I better
okay,
go.
Okay, Dave, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's been the 909 Podcast. We'll talk to you next week. Bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.